The Big News Coming Soon podcast is proudly sponsored by BRB Homes. BRB Homes is Ireland's number one award-winning manufacturer of factory-built homes. We take your home from start to finish. Our homes are A-rated and meet planning regulations. We build to your requirements and your budget. The cost includes your home being turnkey and our chartered engineer's fees. Please get in touch for a viewing of our show homes, a brochure, or for more information. Let BRB Homes take the stress out of your build. Check out brbhomes.ie.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Big News Coming Soon. And this week, I'm delighted to be joined by who is the biggest celebrity in Ireland at the moment.
Isn't that great? Doesn't it sound great?
Loretta Blewett. Thank you very much. And I'm honoured to be sitting in this room with you because every TV outlet in the world has been looking for you for the last few weeks. That is true.
The phone has gone awful quiet now all of a sudden, Alan. You know, it was all busy there at the start of April, but it certainly slowed down after that.
Oh, this podcast might change things.
Okay, is that good or bad?
Come here till I ask you, have you recovered from the Joe Biden visit?
Yeah, it was really weird. So like in the lead up to it was like this big, exciting wedding. It was like a royal wedding in Ballina. Like it was just everybody was kind of excited and, you know, there was so much buzz around the town and the place was getting painted and there was been flower beds been laid and everything was looking great and the weather obviously wasn't great, so that took a while. When I saw Dermot from the US Embassy getting a child to Prague and putting it out the day before the president arrived, I knew this is it now, this is real. Thankfully, the child of Prague paid off. In fairness, the weather seemed to get a bit better. But such a come down afterwards. It was weird. It was really hard to explain. It was kind of like after, like, there's a family wedding and then afterwards you have the big party and the fun and all that for the next 2 or 3 days. And then afterwards you're like, oh, I don't know if I'm sick or if I'm just in bad form or I'm tired or whatever, but it was brilliant.
You have to be really careful because after very high highs, there's very low lows, isn't
awful
there?
Awful low lows. It's awful. You feel like, oh God.
For people who don't know then, what's your relation to President Joe Biden?
So my dad blew it, obviously, and Joe Biden's like, well, great, great, great grandfather. So it kind of goes back 3-4 generations would be, obviously, that's where it all started. So I suppose like my dad and him would be like third cousins and then obviously you move down the track again. But so the relationship, the cousin side of things, it's close but not that close, obviously. It's like we all have American relations, don't we? They come and find you after years and years of tracing their Irish relatives and, you know, they all want to be cousins with someone from Ireland, don't they? Americans love having Irish blood in them. So there's no difference in this. Just so happens that he's the president of the United States. So that's how the relationship goes. He's very obviously fond of his Blewett connection. He talks about it quite regularly. And the Finnegans then in loud as well. So,
do you remember when you first found out you were related to Joe Biden?
Yeah, so we kind of would have always known that there was that link there. And there was, I think, maybe, God, I don't know, maybe 40 years ago, before I, way, way before I was ever born or thought of, Alan, there was relations of his. He had come to Mayo and, you know, visited my family's kind of home in Knockmore, because the Ballina house, that only kind of pierced, or Garden Street, that kind of only came on stream as things were dug up and all of that. But the Knockmore connection would have been strong in the Blewett name then. So there was relations and pictures and all of that from maybe 40, 50 years ago. So we always knew, like, you'd know you'd relations, but you didn't really follow up on them as such. But then the media were interested in it, obviously, when he became vice president. So I decided then that was the time to insist that he come and visit us in Ireland. And
you contacted him.
I got on to his office, and, you know, just we made that bond initially and that connection, and then obviously they were the vice president's office in the United States. So coming to Ireland until it came up and it was part of the plan, that's when they started then getting in contact with me, and it was like, oh, look, we're going to arrange this and that and the other. So it was really from then. So that would have been 2016. And that was his first time being in Ireland. He had been to the north, but not down to this side of the country. So for him, it was his first time coming to Ireland as well. So that was the start of a beautiful relationship, it has to be said.
So he was here as vice president.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a little hullabaloo, not as big of a hullabaloo as last time.
Yeah.
There was the motorcade, and there was the security. And then I remember meeting him in Braffy House one day.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And nobody knew he was there.
Yeah.
I met him in the corridor.
Yeah.
Where he was just walking back from the bathroom. And I was like, is that Joe Biden?
Yeah.
And then he had obviously visited when he wasn't in office, was it? Or
yeah, so obviously he came in 2016, and then I...
As Vice President,
yeah. And I said, look, before you leave office, because obviously it was a second term as Vice President, can I come and visit you in the White House? And he said, oh, absolutely. And he got his staff over and he said, look, make sure Larisha gets to come to the White House, blah, blah, blah. So as it turns out, I got to visit, and it was the very last week before he left office. The staff had, you know, come to the realisation that that was going to be the quietest week where they could actually plan something without there being changes and him having to go somewhere last minute or whatever. So it turns out I was actually there the day he got the Medal of Freedom, but nobody knew that he was going to get it. So they had planned for me to go and visit. It was sort of like, oh, he'll be able to show you around and, you know, do all that. And then when I arrived in Washington, I said, oh, can I bring my brother with me? And they were like, oh, yeah. So the two of us headed off. I mean, like, talk about last minute. And you saw that when he visited here, nobody knew what was going on. I mean, on the Tuesday, I found out I was able to go for the Wednesday, like to be there in the Wednesday afternoon. So that's how last minute everything is when it comes to, I suppose, that high office.
Yeah.
So we arrived over, and then they rang me when I arrived off the plane, and they said, oh, look, change of plan. The president has now blocked off the vice president's schedule for basically most of the day tomorrow. And I was like, well, I'm here now. And they were like, oh, I know, yeah, but look, come anyway, the staff will show you around, and, you know, hopefully you'll get to see him. As it turns out, they didn't know either that he was getting the Medal of Freedom. And so then in the morning when I arrived over, it was all hush hush, go into this room, don't say you're here, the president wants to make a presentation to the vice president. And then went into the room, and there's probably about maybe 50 people there, mostly staff and his family. And me and my brother stuck there in the back. Well, not even, I think, like, the third row. And he straight away, like, he had seen me maybe in that, it was May, June time when he'd been here. And I hadn't seen him again. And straight away on stage, he was like, oh my God, you're here, you know. So, like, I couldn't believe that he'd even remembered me, you know, that sort of way.
Yeah.
So being there for the Medal of Freedom was obviously incredible. And it was such a special day. And it was probably, like, in, you know, going back now from memory, it's going to be like a historic day to have been there. So that was brilliant. You know, we got down to see the Oval Office where Barack Obama was. We were in his office in the West Wing, you know, and it was just lovely to have such freedom in the White House. But obviously, because he was vice president, that was, easier to do. There wasn't as much pressure on. But then I had said to him, look, would you come and turn the sod on the Mayo Hospice for us? And he said to me, well, look, I will try, but I can't commit to it yet, whatever. So he left office, and that's why you met him in Brafey House, because he had come to turn the sod on the Mayo Hospice for us 6 months after he'd left office. So 6 months after you leave, well, it's just outside 6 months, because you get security as vice president for 6 months after you leave office, and after that, then you're on your own.
Wow.
And his staff used to say to me, you know, it's hilarious. Like, for 8 years, he wasn't allowed to drive a car. He wasn't allowed, you know, there was never traffic on the road. Wherever he went, somebody else drove him. The roads were closed off. If he wanted to go to mass, he wasn't in a rush. He'd come into the office after he left as vice president, and he would say, God, traffic is a bitch this morning. And they'd say, well, sir, like, it's 11 a.m. There's no traffic now. You're not in rush hour. Or he couldn't believe the price of, like, milk, or how much, like, dry cleaning cost or stuff like that, because he never ever had to carry money or, you know, buy stuff for himself. Everything was always taken care of by somebody else. So then he got to drive again and all of that. So he rented a car down in Shannon and drove up. Was delighted with himself driving.
This is hilarious.
Driving through the
road. Flying into Shannon, renting a car.
Yeah.
Hiring a car.
Hiring a car, driving up with his brother and his nephew. And they were like, geez, he was driving like way too fast for these Irish roads. We were nearly getting sick. But he was loving it because he's a car fanatic. And I don't know if you've seen some of the videos of him just obsessed with old cars and all that. So he came up. I brought him to, he turned the sod, stayed in Westport. And then I took him to Ballina for a day. And he said, look, I'd love to do the walk again, what I did as vice president. I don't know where I was. The streets were packed with people, blah, blah, blah. So we did the walk through, and like nobody knew it was him. As you said, he's just walking around with no security, baseball hat on him, him stopping, chatting to people and shaking babies' hands, and people going, who's this fucking weirdo, you know? And, you know, nobody realised that it was him. And I brought him into a cafe in Ballina, John Barrett, who owns the post house in Ballina. And John and his wife Mary lived in Boston for years and, you know, had votes in America and all of the rest of it. So I brought him in, never said anything, sitting down, and John's there taking the order, and he does a double take, and he's like, what is that? So we got a picture, and it was lovely. So he absolutely loved that. And he referred to it in his speech when he was in Ballina as well, that he came back in 2017, it probably was. And he said, like, I came with no cavalcades and no, or motorcades, whatever they're called, and no security, just me, myself and my brother, and, you know, got to see Ballina in a different light, you know.
But the relationship between you and President Biden is obviously genuine and obviously very close, because he has referred to you in so many speeches.
Yeah.
By name, you know, Loretta, like, she's a great bit of stuff. Yeah. Like,
how? I know, we're close. We are close. And I do have a good relationship with him. And he's very good to me in terms of the stuff that he's done for the hospice. It's been incredible. And like, we were opening the Roscommon Hospice, and like, he sent a video as the President of America. You know, like, if I ask him to do something, he'll do it. Like, it's not, it's weird. Like, it is weird when you say it out loud. Or
how do you ask? You can't exactly like send him a WhatsApp.
Yeah, no.
Hey, Joe.
I don't WhatsApp him, and he definitely doesn't use TikTok because of he's not into the whole China thing. But no, I mean,
everything has to go through channels.
Yeah,
does it?
His staff, and so like, he always. It's amazing if his staff turn over, like, for instance, his PA. If he gets a new PA or anything, there's always an introductory email with me, and the PA person's like, oh, here's X, this person, this is Loretta, look, whatever Loretta needs, kind of thing.
Wow.
It's always that. It's weird. You kind of like, oh. And then you kind of think, oh, yeah, right. Like, as if I'm going to ask them for something and they're definitely not going to reply to me, or they're definitely just going to pretend they never got that email. But, like, straight away, every time they come back, they just, you know, like, I don't ask for that much. Like, I'm not going to say, oh, can I go to, like, you know, X place on holidays with you or whatever. Like, I'm not going to be asking too much. But when I do ask, he responds. Okay. And you don't have to wait a long time for it to happen. So I have now insisted that I go and stay in the White House. And that has been accepted. So I just need to now decide.
You insisted?
I insisted. All like, right. I insisted the last time I was going. I was like, no. I said, like, I don't know if you heard the story. I thank my great beloved husband decided to share the story with the nation about
the haircut.
Yes, like, I mean, seriously, I was like, thanks a million. And he goes, Larita, you destroy yourself every week in your own podcast. He was like, I'm pretty sure if I write something about it, it's not that big of a deal.
All right, for people who don't know, there's a story going around in the media that you had the chance to be on Air Force One.
Yeah.
And fly from Dublin to Ireland West Airport.
Yes. So what happened was, we're at the dinner in Dublin Castle. And
la-di-da.
Yes, la-di-da. It was great. It was lovely, blah, blah, blah. And I was chatting to him. And I said to him, like, I talk to him now probably inappropriately in a way, because, you know, all his staff are very much yes, sir, no, sir, you know, reverential, how it's probably supposed to be. But I don't really have that relationship. I have a very kind of a friendly, open, kind of happy, kind of easygoing relationship with him. I don't feel like, oh, God, this is the President of the United States and you have to be reverential to him. I don't ever get that feeling from him. So as a result, we're very easygoing.
A bit like if your teacher in school was your dad.
Yeah.
You don't have to call him sir.
No, but I do call him Mr. President. I never call him Joe. I just think that's a step too far. Right. So I still call him Mr. President. And I said to him, like, what's the story? I was like, I thought I'd be on Air Force One this week with you. And he goes, but sure, you are. He said, I presume that's sorted. Like, you're with me, you know, tomorrow and all that. And I said, well, no, like, I haven't been formally invited onto Air Force One. And he goes, oh, God, he said, we need to get that sorted immediately. And I went, no, because there was queues of people waiting to talk to him. Not like queues, but there was people waiting to get a picture with him or talk to him. And he goes, oh, no, no, he said. And he grabbed me by the arm. He goes, no, no, he said, we need to get this sorted now. And I said, no, I'll come back to you later and you can get it sorted. Just relax. I don't want to go and make a big scene. Like, Jesus, the staff already probably hate me. So, you know, that's easy. And he goes, no, no, he said, everyone else has to wait. So he calls over the staff. He's like, she goes, yes, sir, whatever you need, sir. And he said, Larita's travelling with us tomorrow on Air Force One, yeah? And she went, well, Sam. Like, and when you saw the entourage of people that had to go in cars and buses and all of the rest of it that couldn't go on Air Force One, I don't know the reasons for it all, but she goes, well, obviously anything you want, sir, is the answer is yes. And he goes, well, great, yeah, like, well, Larita's with me then tomorrow. And she was sort of uncomfortable by this idea, as in, I would say, she goes, it's like 11 o'clock at night, are you joking me? Like, what am I supposed to do here? Like, and I said to her, look, I said, it's fine, don't worry about it. I said, sure, look, it's a bit tricky now, I have things on in the morning. I said, I have an appointment, I said, down in Ballina. I said, I have to go back there tonight. I said, or down in Foxford. I said, I have things to be doing. I said, it's grand, it probably doesn't suit. And he was like, I'm the president, he said, I can do whatever I want. Anything I want to do, it's not a problem, Larita. It's not a problem, is it? And she goes, no, sir, it's not a problem. And I was thinking, she was thinking, would you ever fuck off and go away from me, right? So I said, oh, I'm sensing that this is a bit tricky. And he goes, no, it's not tricky at all. And I said, mightn't be tricky for you, but I said, it seems to be tricky for everyone else. I said, and I've stuff on in the morning anyway, sure, I'll see you when you get down. And he goes, no, he says, I'm not happy with that. He said, let's get that sorted. And she goes, okay, sir, I'll go and get it sorted now. And I could see her going, don't make eye contact with her again. Don't make eye contact. So then she did come back to me. She's like, oh, look, Larita, like, we can definitely move things around and, you know, you can drive. And I said, no, forget about it. I said, I've got an appointment at 8:30 in the morning. I said, I have a load of stuff on. I said, I'll see you when you get to Mayo. And I was like, oh my God. Well, my husband nearly killed me. He was like, you can't say no to that. And I was like, but sure, it's only going to be hassle. I said, the car is here. I said, there's just too many things that aren't going to work out. I said, I don't like things being sprung on me. So he was going mad and everyone else went mad afterwards. But
there was probably a hairdresser in Air Force One.
It probably was. There's bloody, I think there's somewhere where you can have a quick operation in there. So I'm pretty sure they could have done my hair and maybe dress me and all for that matter.
So it's true. You had a hair appointment that morning.
I did have
in
a hair appointment. I did. And I didn't get home to bloody home to Knockmore until about 3:30 in the morning, so I wasn't in the best of shape getting my hair done at 8:30 anyway.
Do you regret it now?
No, sure. I mean, like,
well, it wasn't the real Air Force One. Like, I know every plane that he's on is called Air Force One,
but this was,
but
like,
it wasn't the
it wasn't the big massive one. But also I had already questioned the staff about this, and by all accounts it's basically a direct replica for Air Force One.
Okay.
The same food is served on it. The seats are the exact same. It's just not a big cargo plane as such, but it's it's probably like a plane we would go to on holidays to Spain to, or it's that kind of size. It's still not a, like, not a little private jet either, you know.
Yeah.
So, do I regret it? I mean, I still don't, but I'm sure I will eventually regret it.
But like, you're hopping a skip from Dublin to Ireland West. You'd be there in 20 minutes anyway.
Exactly. Actually, by the time you'd be up, you'd be down. There'd be no sense to it. But look.
Because I was on the tarmac in Ireland West waiting for it to land, and I got a photo of the motorcade driving into Dublin Airport at 10 past one.
Right.
And I think he was on the tarmac in Ireland West at 2 o'clock.
Yeah. So there you go.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I probably will regret it. I'm awful for, like, not overthinking things too much either. So it didn't happen. It's gone now. Yeah. And sure, if the chance comes up again, I won't be as naive to say I have a hair appointment. I shouldn't be planning things that far in advance anyway.
And when you were going then to meet him in Ballina, like, was it all drama, like, organising times to be there, how to get in, how not to get in? Because from a media point of view, everything was so difficult for me, like, to cover and me to get into places. But you were getting in past the next checkpoint.
Yeah.
Was that difficult?
So obviously I was going to the hospice to meet him. Again, it was last minute. It was kind of unsure whether it was going to happen or it wasn't going to happen.
This was so funny. Sorry to interrupt you, because I was up in the primary care centre getting a checkup done, and there was two women two nurses in a cubicle beside me saying, "I hear he's coming to the hospice."
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
"But don't tell anyone."
Yeah, yeah. It's the worst kept secret.
Yeah. Like. And then there was 4 miles of barriers from Cahill Duffy's roundabout.
As if everyone didn't know, yeah.
To Island 80.
Yeah.
And right up to the front door of the hospice. So it was like the worst kept secret in the town.
And guards everywhere. And
people putting up cameras.
Yeah, yeah.
The funny thing about Castlebar was there's CCTV everywhere in Castlebar that hasn't worked for the last 20 years. And now you'd see two Robin Redbreasts making love on a roundabout because all the cameras are fixed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's just cameras. There was a lot of suspicious ones that went up on the way into Ballina as well. They're gone now. Surprise, surprise. But yeah, of course it was. I was then like, I was appointed, sounds ridiculous as well, but I was appointed a liaison officer to have from the White House so that anything that I needed or any questions I had would be answered by a direct person for the week. So basically the lead up to it, any questions I had about the trip or anything like that, there was just basically one guy that was, I'm sure he had 10 other jobs to do as well, but he was, you know, "Larita, whatever you need, Larita, yes sir, yes sir." Well, not yes sir, but that kind of stuff. So I went to the hospice and then it was all, "Oh, you can't park your car here and security here." And so I was like, "No, I insist I'm bringing my car in." Because I was like, "I'm just going to push all the boundaries here. I didn't go in Air Force One. I'm going to make sure that people know I'm here." So of course then I was like, "Oh, I want to bring my car in. I won't have high shoes on, I can't be walking for miles, blah blah blah." So
now from their point of view, they're thinking, "We can't bring a car in because it might have a suspect device in it."
Well,
and you're thinking about your shoes.
Yes, my feet. so anyway, of course then it was agreed. It was, I had to go through Secret Service and then the guards and Secret Service. It was going on for ages and I was like, "Well, no, I'm pretty sure I've been told that I can bring the car in." And then this was like by a White House one. And then it was like Secret Service said no. And then the guard said no. And then I was like, "Cheer one, look, they're saying no." Oh my God. Well, the whole thing was changed anyway. So then the Secret Service had to sweep the car. They had to have like 6 fellas there and a dog to, I swear, it was just, I was like, "I'm pushing the boat out here. I don't care how many fellas have to do it." So they were in with the little tiny flash lamps in through all the bonnet of the car. The boot had to be popped. The whole, everything had to be opened. The dog was in the car going through it. They were like putting the dog underneath the car. They were putting the flash, they had this thing on wheels here. There's like a mirror underneath it and the flash lamp on it to go underneath the car. It basically, it was like a full sweep of the car. It's like you'd see on CSI Miami Job, like, or so all of the car had to be sweeped and straight in to the door of the hospice. And I was happy then once I was allowed in, just to make a point of it. But also my dad got to see him there as well. My dad's in a wheelchair, so they allowed him in as well, but it was like accompany the car, check the wheelchair, like everything was like over the top. But they're American, like, I mean, everything, like, I was watching the NFL draft on the television today, like everything is a drama, like everything's a big
show. They do seem to love drama,
you know. It's not like, it's not like, oh, geez, like, we do things here and it's like try and get it over and done with as quick as possible and move it on, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas everything's massive and it's all
Ireland Day, like get 80,000 people in and out as quick as you can.
As quick as
into
you can and get
you.
Out and just like walk yeah. for miles.
What's that?
So that's what it is. Yeah. You know, if that was, if the All-Ireland was American, like it'd be, you know,
you'd have to
Super
get up on
Bowl
the Wednesday.
Sunday, like, are you joking me? It's like, I mean, the whole thing would just be a totally other, you know, maybe we need to take a leaf out of their book. But yeah, so look, it was an exceptional trip and it was fun.
Let's talk about the hospice for a moment. So you work for the hospice,
yes.
is it? What's your role in the hospice?
I do major donor fundraising. I've worked on that. I worked in the hospice since 2000 and... But at the end of 2014, I joined the hospice. I did community fundraising, fundraising manager, that kind of role first. And then we had to build two hospices. So we had a big job on our hands. Were we going to get a bank loan? Were we going to get donors? All that sort of stuff. So I work in fundraising, basically. And
since that time, you have built two hospices.
We have built two hospices. And we didn't have to get a bank loan.
Wow.
We were able to do that through donor fundraising, through general fundraising, community fundraising, all of that. So it was incredible. And it's incredible for...
And you've also...
For the charity not to have to be kind of under pressure for the rest of its... like forever to be paying back money, you know, it's not simple.
And you also completed a hospice during lockdown.
Yeah, it was interesting to see that side of it. And we worked with everything, every single part of the hospice from the day the sod was turned to the doors being opened, like the construction, everything, the construction, the people who worked on the site all the time. Like we might sometimes walk in and, you know, and say, oh, we wanted to bring a donor in or we wanted to come in and see something. There was never, like we all know builders and carpenters, and it's a stressful job and they don't want people in on top of them, or electricians or whatever role they're doing. They don't want people in when they've cables thrown here or they've blocks thrown here. But it was so peaceful and lovely from the get-go to that site to now being open to patients and all the rest of it. And everything just worked so well and during lockdown. And we also had a period of time where the weather was like really, really hot. And so they had to, instead of missing days on the building site, they got the lads to come in at 5 o'clock in the morning and work until, you know, early in the morning and then stop because of the hot weather and all of
wow.
that. Like everybody was tied into it in a more than a job way. It was, this is part of our community. This is part of us. It was such a powerful experience for me to be part of. And I wasn't even on the building site, but going in and seeing it. And it's just an amazing facility for like, I think Gabriel Byrne was on the Late Late Show probably like 8, 9 years ago, and he's a big advocate for hospice. And he was talking about how there should be a hospice in every county in the country. And even now, in the year we're in, there isn't a hospice in every county in the country, which is sad.
Scandalous.
Yeah, it's scandalous.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it shouldn't be down to fundraising and it shouldn't be down to charities or it shouldn't... But that's the way it is. And it's... lovely to be part of it, and it makes you feel it gave me a whole other understanding of empathy and respect for others when I started working for the hospice. Because you're caught up in your life and you're doing your own thing, but until you're actually talking to the people, the families, or the patients, or the people who use hospice, that's when you realize how important it is and how. It's a sad thing to say. It's a beautiful and like deeply required place in the community, but it's also great to see that it's there and what a difference it makes to people. And people message me all the time, or I talk to people all the time, and they say, like, if somebody's brother or mother or father dies in the hospice, and I have a connection to them in some way or another, or through Facebook or Instagram or whatever, they'll message me and say, like, the experience in there was just, like, hard to put into words. It was just beautiful for the patient, for us. And, like, we were able to learn so much from other hospices when we were building our Mayo one and our Roscommon one. For instance, one part of the research was that a patient would love there was a hospice in Dublin and they didn't have this facility where the patient wanted to go outside in her dying days to feel the rain on her face. And she couldn't do that because the bed, she was bed bound. And so we were able to make our rooms, build our rooms in a way where we were able to put the bed out. There's a door there where the bed can go out and each room has a private little garden and the bed can go out there and the patient, if they want to feel the sun or the rain or the wind or whatever it is, that they can do that. The rooms are made up for the patient and with the patient in mind. So you go into the room, it doesn't look like a hospital room. It doesn't have like all the oxygen pumps and everything on display. Everything's hidden away behind a cupboard, or so it's just a bed. The television is important. We've got blinds that are integrated into the door and the window that the patient operates. So if the patient wants sunlight or the patient wants darkness or whatever the patient wants, the patient can do. It's all there at a touch of a button for the patient. I was talking to a lad who worked on the site and he said to me, like, it was just, gave me a whole different perspective on things, but just been involved in the building of it and just seeing the attention to detail for the room that you wouldn't see in a hospital. But people think, oh, it's a hospice, it's all the same. It's not, it's completely different. We've a working kitchen in each hospice where if a patient wants a fillet steak or a dessert or something, they can have that. We've got a family room that if a patient is unwell, not well enough to be at home, but well enough to get out of bed and they want to watch a movie or have a movie night with their kids or a takeaway or whatever, we've got a room for that. We've got an apartment that if a family need to come and stay, that they've got that facility there. We've daycare facilities, we've hairdressers, we've got like, it's patient-centered, but it's perfect for that, you know. You can have a wedding there. There was a wedding there recently where the mother of the bride passed away and they wanted to, before she did, they wanted to have the wedding and they brought it forward and the chef did the wedding cake. And,
wow.
You have kind of Holy Communions there. There's a little private courtyard that you can have different events there. Before we opened our hospice in Mayo, we had a patient from the county who had to go elsewhere to get married and have her wedding there. She was in the hospice care room in hospice care, and that was sad that she wasn't able to do that in her own county. You know, she had to go elsewhere for it. So,
and is it fully self-funded, or does it get any government funding?
No, the HSC now pay for the running costs of it, which is brilliant.
But you had to build it yourself.
We had to build it, and then our ongoing, obviously, we still have ongoing costs that would be involved in the hospice, and then we've got a home care team who we continue to fund as well. Who, you know, not every patient. Generally, it's about a 3-week stay in a hospice. Right. So either, and not everyone dies in the hospice as well. And like, I talked to somebody recently and their granny was in there and she was in there and she got better and now she's well again. You know, it's not going to the hospice, like you're never going to come out of it. It just depends on the patient's care, the patient's needs, whatever that may be. You could have a patient who doesn't want to die at home, who wants to go in because they might have young kids, or it's just not, might not be suitable for them to be at home. Mm-hmm. Or you could have a patient who isn't well enough to be at home yet, but they want to be well enough to be able to go home. And that's what our amazing doctors and nurses and carers and all that.
What's really incredible about it is there was no great scandal where you said you were going to, I don't know the figures, but you didn't say you were going to build it for 1 million and it ended up costing 100 million.
No.
Like, no. Everything was done.
That's why,
there, thereabouts.
Yeah.
And it's amazing when you let people at it themselves.
Yeah.
What they can achieve. Whereas if this was probably a government funded project, it would have been estimated, oh, sure, we'll build it for 2 million. It ended up costing a trillion.
Yeah. Well, look, you see that with the Children's Hospital, don't you? There was jokes when we were opening the, I think it was Roscommon Hospice, and Stephen Donnelly was the Minister for Health. I think he still is. But, you know, there was jokes that they needed to get Martina Jennings to go and take over the Children's Hospice, our CEO, or the Children's Hospital, because, like, we wouldn't be able to afford to do that. Like, you put a figure on something, we're a charity, we have to make this money up from nowhere, basically. You know,
but
like, how this runs on, I don't know, but...
Yeah.
Maybe it's a better thing that there wasn't government funding, you know. Maybe it was better that it was.
But it goes to show how much respect you have for the the donors.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't just go willy-nilly and say, right, sure, look, if we need to get another million, we'll get it somewhere.
Yeah, but also...
It was realistic.
Yeah, it's realistic. But also you're dealing with, you know, donors who are made money for a reason. They're not going to give it away that easy either. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it's got to be a joined up thinking. And I think because it was something special and it was in our community and it's made such a huge difference now. And we're so thrilled that the two of them are opened and functioning. And, you know, we're so thankful to the staff and the people who keep it open and keep it going every day. And it's just, I marvel at the nurses. I marvel at our home care team as well. Like, I knew nothing about hospice other than I was working in it. And then in 2015, my mother was diagnosed with cancer, since passed away. But I got a totally different understanding of hospice then, you know, because for the last couple of months of her illness, we had hospice in at home. And again, even though I worked there and I was always talking about hospice, when the word hospice was described to my mother that it was time for her to have it, she was like, oh, no way, I don't want it. Because it's a fearful word for so many people. You hear hospice, you think end of life, you think, oh God, if I start it, it's the end, you know. And then when people actually have it, they realise, oh my God, the quality of life now for me is so much better. I feel so much better. I've got such more care and attention from these people who are coming to my house, who are answering questions that I wasn't maybe able to ask in doctors or nurses in the hospital. And it was just an incredible experience for my mother. It was an incredible experience for us, and it gave me a whole different, even though I thought my eyes were opened already from talking to other patients. There was this lady that told me, and it's always stuck with me, she wanted to do a fundraiser and she wasn't sure how to go about it. And she said, you know, my daughter is dead 20 years now and she was only 19 when she died. And she said every other week, the nurse that minded her, her hospice nurse, calls into me and visits for a cup of tea if she's passing. And you just think, like fuck me, that's like, you know, you don't see that. You don't think of that. You don't. And like she said, it makes such a difference to me to know that I have that link always with my daughter, you know, because, you know, death is hard to obviously get your head around for a long time. And it's just that you get more used to it. It's not that you get over the person, but it's that you get used to it. And I think talking about it and talking about it with somebody who you know how they suffered, you know, it makes such a difference. So the stories that you hear from the patients who or the families who use it, it just gives you that kind of boost to go, oh, great, I'm so glad I'm part of it, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm privileged to be part of the hospice.
So then when Joe Biden was here visiting, he turned the sod, obviously, when he came back.
Yeah, in 2017.
And then you got him back in again 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And there's a plaque in the ground.
Yeah, so we put that plaque down when we're opening the hospice, and it's in memory of his son, Bo, and it's basically where he turned the sod on the Mayo Hospice. And he was just so good with his time in the Mayo Hospice. You know, it was a private visit.
I've heard this a few times now.
Yeah.
I've heard that he gave loads of time to everybody and you couldn't get him out of there.
Yeah, yeah. And the staff were like, come on, come on. But like his staff had kind of said to me, I'm not sure if he's going to be able to see the patients. I was like, oh God, like
because
he needs to see the
when
patients.
We were at Ireland West Airport waiting for him to land, we were told that he was running late and he wouldn't get to the hospice.
Yeah.
We were told that the hospice trip was cancelled.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was going to be the first one that was cancelled. But like, I mean, I heard that earlier on in the week and I just was on the phone going, you cannot cancel this trip, no way.
Yeah.
So he then said to me when he got out of the car and we looked at the plaque, he said, Larissa, I've got some books. He wrote a book about his son, Bo. And, you know, that story of his two sons been in hospital for like months after their mother, his wife, died. His little daughter got killed in that horrific car accident in the 70s. And then, you know, Bo had problems, you know, with head injuries they had from the accident. And then he died from brain cancer, which was, you know, sad to think. Was there a link there eventually after all these years? But he got out of the car. And the first thing that obviously a lot, everyone would have heard the story about the priest in Ireland or in Knock Shrine. You know, that wasn't set up. That wasn't supposed to happen. You know, they didn't know anything about the priest until they arrived. And then Father Richard had said, oh, you know, we've a priest here who worked in the hospital ex-hospital, yeah, a military hospital.
So tell us this story.
Yeah.
The priest who read Bo his last rites, was that correct?
Yeah, so...
Was in Ireland, was in Knocktrine.
He's now in Knocktrine. He's based there or whatever for a period of time. And, well, I only heard the story from Hunter and from Joe when they got out of the car and they were like, you'll never guess what happened. You know, we were there. Father Richard was saying, oh, we have a priest here who worked in the military hospital in just outside Washington, wherever. And they were like, oh, Bo said, oh, or Hunter said, oh, what was his name? Oh, his name's Frank O'Grady or whatever. And they said, oh my God, you're joking me. Like, that's the priest who gave Bo his last rites. And they were like, no way. And so they got him and brought him over. And because Hunter had spent so much time, the priest had been in and out and he'd been close to it and then to death and then rallied again. And so he had been with him quite a bit in the lead up to his death. And so Hunter had got to know the priest. And that was how...
That must have been really emotional.
But it was weird. It was weird that they were coming from there to the hospice, to where Bo's name was, you know, forever is going to be associated. And from being over and meeting, like, it's a bit of a, like, you know, weird thing.
Yeah.
But so we were saying, oh, look, I said to him, look, you have to see the patients before you leave. And he says, oh, look, absolutely, I will. And he said to me, look, I've got some books. He'd written a book about Bo. He said, would it be okay if I gave a couple of copies out and signed them? And I said, look, I'm sure they would love that. You know, and he was so open with his time with the patients. And for me, that was the most powerful part of the trip. That was something really special about that. You know, the rest of it was publicity and it was PR and it was very public. This was very private and very one-on-one time with people. And it was powerful.
Yeah, because even the photo that was going around in the media the next day would, you know, it was a tear-jerking photo.
Yeah.
And all it was just the four or five of you standing looking down at the plaque.
Mm. And what happened there was there wasn't supposed to be, obviously there must have been, I don't know, was there like 25 cars of, like, you know, there's two ambulances follow them, you know.
I think there was around 40.
Was there, yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, I just know there were like so many of them.
Yeah.
But there was a load of them were the, you know, the press, the media that were following them on the trip. And they wanted get some pictures of the hospice. And the team were like, no, this is a private trip. You can't get out of the cars. You can't get out of the cars. Mm. And obviously they're respectful because they're part of the entourage as such. And then they agreed to let them take that one photo. But it was amazing. Even they came in, they were really silent. You didn't even know they were there. I didn't even realise they were there. And there must have been, I don't know how many of them there getting the photos and the pictures and all of that. But you were oblivious to it because it was so private. They came in, they took the photos and they were gone again,
okay.
Back into the cars, and then the rest of it was private. But it was lovely.
B&B Homes make your dream home a reality. We do it all from start to finish. Your one-stop shop to becoming a homeowner. Log on to brbhomes.ie.
I have a question for you now.
Yes.
Do you think I look like Hunter Biden?
Jesus, I didn't think of it until now.
Hang on, I turn sideways now. Maybe the side profile.
Yeah,
or?
You need the slick back hair now. That's oh,
I can work on that. Yeah,
you need to let the hair grow a bit and slick it back. Yeah. Jesus, you know, you might just do.
A few people have said online that I look like him.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. You've run the same jawline here.
Yeah.
Yeah, very good.
Well, we might be distant relations.
Here you go again. Yeah, great. Come on, go on the list. Yeah.
Does any of the online abuse affect you or do you see it?
Online abuse, I'll say it now and then I'll get it. I don't really get that much online abuse. I don't really open myself up for it. This was interesting. Like before you'd put up something about Joe Biden in a tweet or something, that'd be like, oh, same old story, kind of, oh, he's this or he's that or whatever. But this trip, I didn't get any of it. I didn't, like, you'd be getting letters about, oh, he's murdering children and all that sort of stuff. And you're, you know, get all the sort of letters. I didn't get anything this time.
Okay. Well, that's good.
I got none of it. Now, if I went looking for it, yeah. I might find it. But I didn't get directly targeted by by any of it.
Does reading the comments under, like, you might be looking at the Connacht Telegraph or the Western People.
I never read them.
No, you don't?
I never read them.
Well, that's good.
I started doing the podcast with the boys and, you know, you'd be up there and you'd be out, put out there in the world. And I don't necessarily want that. It's a weird thing. I love doing the podcast. I love what comes with it. But I don't really like the too much interaction on the social media stuff. I don't really put myself out too much for it. I never really use social media that much.
You have a boundary there.
Yeah. And so I there's stuff that I don't post and stuff. And so I don't really open myself up to too much. And then I put stuff up for the podcast or I put up a video. So I don't really get an awful lot of it. You would always get abuse from people that say, oh, if you're promoting something or you're, oh, who do you think you are? And you're kind of like, I don't think I'm anybody. I'm just doing it because for X or Y reason. So I don't, I specifically, when I started the podcast, I didn't put myself up to read the comments that are underneath it. Because I was always afraid. I don't want to hear them. I don't want to, like, if that was the case, I'd be constantly, like, it can be a very lonely place then, you know. You're there doing something that you like doing, your podcast or whatever it is that I'm doing. And if you're getting abused for it, or you're getting criticized for it, like, everybody... nobody is that thick skin that it isn't going to affect them.
The reason I ask is because when we were down, I was working with ITV the day before he arrived, and we were going around Ballina, and we went in and they showed us this brick that they were going to present to him.
Yeah. So I saw your video, yeah.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, of course.
Did it annoy you? Did it upset you?
No, it didn't. No. I do get annoyed and offended when people talk about him as in Sleepy Joe and, you know, all that sort of stuff and how he's... But then I... just like, you let that go too, so... You know.
Yeah, because I genuinely wouldn't want to have offended...
I enjoyed it.
And I like to try and use a little bit of comedy to highlight...
Of course, yeah, and you're good at it and it comes easy to you.
So people are saying, like, you know, fair enough. So the video has got 1.4 million views on Instagram and it's gone viral now. And it obviously went into a few of these Trump groups who...
the bots were after you.
And hundreds, thousands in fact.
Yeah.
Slid into my DMs, kind of saying this, that, and the other, and why are you giving him airtime, and why are you giving him this, and these they don't follow me, they don't know me, they don't know anything about me.
Yeah, see, once it goes viral, it's up there for them to find it, you know.
But from my point of view, anyway, I was just trying to highlight the fact that this brick came from his ancestral home here in a funny way.
Yeah,
tie it in with Father Ted. Everyone knows Father Ted and the brick scene. But I honestly didn't expect the abuse I got.
Yeah.
Like thousands of messages.
It's horrid, isn't it? It's horrid. Like, it's really horrid. But
then I started to wonder, you know, does that affect you? Like, do you get upset when you see those comments?
No, I don't. So, I don't get them. I have to say my experience with Instagram is good in that I don't really, like, again, you can filter out a lot of it. You can not accept it, or you can. And then... Twitter, I mean, you'll always get. Yeah. I mean, it's always people that don't have a name, you know.
Twitter's a rough spot now, in fairness.
You know, it's someone who's not brave enough to put their own name on their Twitter account, you know, and they're all talk, you know. You meet them then, and you know, if you met them, they'd be all, oh, hi, yeah.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Hi, can I get a selfie, Alan?
Interesting. My biggest online troll on Facebook is a cameraman, and I've met him at so many events. We work with the same companies. He's never once acknowledged me in real life. Doesn't talk to me, doesn't say anything to me. He's the only person I've ever had to block on Facebook.
It's just too weird.
And even 2 days ago, I was doing a thing with Mayo Day and he's the only person that abused me on Facebook.
But why? Like, I don't understand these people. What is, obviously they're... Look, it says more about them than it says about, you know, you or whoever they're abusing, because it's a case of they've obviously got a lot of issues. But
what's interesting is they can't do it in real life.
No, they like...
I was standing shoulder to shoulder with this guy
when... Well, he wouldn't say a thing to you.
When Joe Biden was landing.
I'm surprised he wasn't up asking you for a picture.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because that's the old bullshit that's...
Yeah.
That is, you know, it's all like, it's all bravado stuff online. It's all.
So my next question then is, right, so thank God you don't see any of that or you don't take it on. And that's great. Well, can
thanks
you.
Thanks now. I'll probably get it now, Alan.
No, and I hope you don't. I hope you don't. But can you describe the Joe Biden you know then?
That's what I mean. And so that's why I get kind of like.
Who's the Joe Biden you know? What is he? Tell us about him.
He's just a kind, caring, really personable man.
But that came across on his trip.
Well, yeah, it does. And in fairness, you can't hide that stuff. You can't manufacture that stuff. You know, somebody told me that when Trump came to Ireland as the president, all he wanted to do was go to his hotel and not to be bothered. And he had an interview. I think he met the Taoiseach in like a
careful
outside
now.
Room.
Yeah, and, I'm going to get so many Trump people onto me now.
Well, go to Alan. This is all Alan's fault. It's not mine, right?
Go on.
Well, like, and so they were working on this trip and they were saying, oh my God, this is bloody the exact opposite. This is like, this man wants to meet everyone. He wants to talk to everybody. He's just a good, down-to-earth man who has lived his life, experienced hardship, experienced tremendous loss by losing his first wife and his daughter in a horrific car accident. His two boys, he was sworn into the Senate at their hospital bed. So he has empathy for people. I see when he's speaking to people whose kids die in school shootings, he talks to them with complete and utter respect and empathy. He's not speaking to them like he's the president of America. He's speaking to them as he's Joe Biden. He's a man who's suffered loss, who understands loss. And that's what he's like to talk to. And I said to you earlier, it was very kind of, it's like me and you chatting. I don't feel like, oh God, he's the president of America. Like, he can't say that to me. You know, he's very good-natured and genuine, and he talks so much about having empathy and respect and dignity for others. And he talks about how his, you know, his father always says, you know, nobody's better than you, no, everyone's your equal. And that's how he lives his life, and that's the kind of person he is. So what you see, and it, I hate this stuff about, oh, he's senile or he can't speak properly. Well, first of all, he had a stutter for all of his childhood life, and anyone who has a stutter will have empathy for that, and how he was able to get over that and go beyond that boundary to become the president of the United States. He had so much to overcome in that alone. Like, he showed me before when he's reading a speech, he has to put lines through it. He has to break up the speech, the sentence, so that he doesn't come to it and stutter. And, you know, because it's always going to be there with you. You just have to learn. You have to learn to overcome it. I don't know. I'm not speaking from experience, but I'm speaking from what he was telling me. You have to, you know, you're always. So when he stops at something, or he says something, or he fluffs over something, it's not that he's senile or that he forgets or that he's like where he is, you know. And then that narrative is always played out, you know. Oh, he's losing his mind.
But that narrative comes from 90% of the content online. Is taken out of context.
Yeah, it's always and taken out.
Like, people need to cop on, because what we do, it's scary at the moment. People will watch a 10-second video and make up their opinion.
But that's the way the world is gone now, Alan. Like,
but people need to take a step back and realise, hang on now a second, where's the other 20 seconds of this video?
Yeah, and
people
now everything can be, like, enhanced so much or, you know, slowed down or sped up or whatever. And you can. And it's for clicks, it's for likes, it's for, you know, that's clickbait. Like, and that's the problem. And now America's gone so divisive, isn't it? And so you're either a Fox News watcher or you're a CNN watcher. There's nowhere down the middle where, like, Matthew McConaughey said in an interview recently, it's hard, we're struggling in America now to actually know what a fact is. Yeah. Like, I mean,
yeah.
The world is going like that.
When I was at
they're ahead of us.
When I was at the airport waiting for the plane to arrive, I got a message saying, oh yeah, look at you there. You're up Fine Gael's hole. How could you possibly consider me up Fine Gael's hole? I'm not associated to any political party. I've never even acknowledged any political party. And I work for the airport or work alongside the airport.
Yeah.
But it's interesting people's perspective where they see, oh, look at your man at the airport. He's obviously up Fine Gael's hole. What's it got to do with Fine Gael?
I know what I'm
saying. It's absolutely nothing to do with them whatsoever.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I mean, you just have to have an unbelievably thick skin and you've just got to laugh all that stuff off, because, like,
And again, I'm not affiliated to any political party, left or right, or Trump or Biden, or I don't support anyone. And
I saw you having to make a video saying, "Hang on, I'm just, you know, getting in on the whole Biden thing." Like, hey, just like, relax, lads.
It was just
relax.
But that's what we do, though, isn't it? Like, Jesus. If something happens in Mayo, it's like, happy days.
Yeah.
This is mighty. Let's do it.
Of course.
Let's get on with it.
I mean, there was the most amount of people to ever be in, like, at a speech. I couldn't believe this. The 27,000 people were in Ballina for a speech. That's the most amount of people that he's ever spoken to at a public event. And you'd think coming from America, there'd be, but for security reasons, they would never allow that many people to gather, I suppose, for an event like that. And he doesn't really go out speaking in public to, you know, on the street or whatever.
Yeah.
So that's why it was a big thing here.
And there was an article as well that revenue went up, hotels were up, restaurants were up, coffee shops were up.
And I hope it continues to do that in the spin-off for him. And it's brilliant. Look, I mean, JFK came, Barack Obama came, who else came? Ronald Reagan came. So, you know, like...
The thing that impressed me the most about him is that he had a busy morning in Dublin, then down into the airport, round Knock, the hospice, and then by the time 10 or 11 o'clock came that night, he got up, he did his speech, he was fresh as a daisy going out onto that stage.
Yeah.
And he didn't fluff up one single word.
No. And
everyone was waiting for it.
Yeah.
Everyone was waiting, what's the fuck up going to be?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's, look, and then they could use that video as a...
And there wasn't one.
Yeah.
How impressive is that at his age?
I mean, it's super impressive. But the other thing to remember is that we retire here at a certain age. They're going berserk in France because they're trying to increase the retirement age by 2 years from 62 to 64 or something like that. We retire here at whatever age it is now. It kind of creeps up here. We don't really know until we're trying to retire and then we can't. But in America, you don't retire. There's no retirement age. Like Nancy Pelosi was a House Speaker for, like, she's still a senator or... But she's 82 years of age. Like, she's an impressive woman. You don't retire in America because you don't have the retirement benefits that you would have here. You know, you don't have a pension and of sorts. You know, things are different over there. The cost of living is so high. So for him to retire, it's not really something he knows to do. He's a politician through and through. He's the age he is. If he runs again or he wins again, he'll be like 86 when he leaves, you know. So it's a big age, but I mean, it was interesting to watch last week. They did a video in America. They went around and I think it was BBC World News or something, and they interviewed maybe 10 or 15 people over 80 and asked them, you know, what do they think about Joe Biden announcing that he was going to run again? And they were like, you know, it's ageism, like, criticizing us at our age. Like, I could be as good as I am and somebody who's 71 or someone who's 61 could be worse. You just don't know. It's the individual, it's the person. And, you know, he has a great team of doctors around him and specialists and family and everyone. Like, he's not, you know, if he's going to be not able to run, he won't run. Like, he's, you see him up close and personal when you're in his company, and he's physically strong. He goes to the gym every day before he starts his day's work. You know, if he wasn't able to do any of that stuff, he wouldn't be running again. And he's passionate about the state of the country, I suppose, and to go again. He feels that it is his duty as an American to serve the people, and that's kind of where it is at.
But I have to tell you, in the lead up to his visit as well, my phone was hopping from people all over the world asking me, do you know Loretta? Can you get Loretta? And I've never been photoed with you or seen with you or associated with you.
Yeah.
Every TV outlet in the world must have been just Googling popular Mayo people or any connection we can get to Loretta at all.
Yeah, I know. Sure. I mean, was your
phone bananas?
Phone was mental. I mean, I think on the day he was there, I think I had like something like 158 unread WhatsApp messages. And I was like, oh, Jesus, what am I supposed to do? Like, how am I supposed to actually go back and read these? I said to my nephew, who's 13, I was like, I need a secretary to go through these. He said, I'll do it for you if you give me a good price, you know. Like, it was all that kind of stuff, emails and phone calls and phone calls and phone calls. And
Alan Clark was one saying, when you do a podcast with me on Monday.
Yeah. I, obviously, as I said to you, like, you know, when you work in the media as well, and I did for a long time, that you sort of get to know a lot of people, and Ireland is a small country, so you're obviously know a lot of people who work in it. So you obviously try and oblige as many people as you can. But there's also limits and burnout and kind of like, oh, how can I, many more times can I tell you the same story? You know, when you're sort of doing it almost robotically, you're kind of like, I don't even know what I said, and that, you know.
It's interesting though, some of the international media don't have any boundaries. Like they will absolutely plague you until you answer the phone,
you, like,
or reply.
And it's kind of like, for what? Like a piece of flesh. Like,
and this is good news. This is a good news story. Could you imagine if it was bad news?
Oh, it's awful. It's awful. I'd hate it. I absolutely hate it. But like, you know, there's only so much you can do, and there's only so much you can say. And so I kind of eventually was like, just let it go and let it go. And look, and I suppose it's my own fault. There was a lot at the start when he, you know, was running for it. I was happy to do those interviews. And so you get to a point where you're like, well, look, you brought it on yourself. So, you know, you take it for, you know, you don't take it personally, and you realise that next week they'll have absolutely zero interest in you. So you just...
Well, I really appreciate your time, and I feel bad being one of those 158 text messages. But
I opened yours, so that's what you've...
Yeah, I know. I do appreciate you taking the time. And I have to mention as well that we're sitting here today in Mount Falcon Estate.
Beautiful.
Acres and acres and acres of woodland. We're in one of the suites upstairs.
These
fabulous armchairs with Foxford cushions all around us. We've had
afternoon tea. That was the big one.
Afternoon tea here on the coffee table in front of us. Lovely coffee. Have you ever had afternoon tea on your podcast?
No, just pints.
Just pints. This is how I roll.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just Guinness. Just Guinness.
I record all my...
I'm disappointed there wasn't a pint here for me, Alan.
Well, I did offer.
You did, in fairness.
I've
had a long weekend, so I mean, I think a pint might push me over the edge.
It was one of the terms and conditions. I said, like, if you want morning porter, that can happen.
Yeah, morning porter. It got so bad we had to take a break from having morning porter, so...
Let's talk about you then for a few moments.
Yeah.
We've crossed paths, or we've had similar journeys.
Yeah, yeah.
We've both come from a radio background, and we've both been fired in to the world of media, and then we both went out starting our own podcasts.
Yeah.
How has your media journey been? Have you enjoyed it?
Yeah, I mean, media is like, it was something I always wanted to do. Like, I was 17, 16 years of age. I was working in Midwest Radio doing match reports at the weekends. And I just loved the buzz of it, you know. I went to Ballyfermot and did radio and TV journalism there. And I loved it. But mostly the audio part of it, never really the TV side of it, never really got me as excited.
Did you find it difficult doing match reports at a 17-year-old being a female?
Yeah, probably.
Because back then, like, it was like Willie the Shoe days, wasn't it?
Yeah, he was the first man there that I worked with,
For people that don't know...
My sister used to do it as well. She was older than me, and she used to do it, you know, with him as well.
For people who don't know, Willie the Shoe was an absolute legend
of
Irish broadcasting, particularly sport. And then for a female to come in under, like, there were sexist times, like, there's no question. Did you find it difficult?
I didn't because I'm born and raised in Gaelic football at home in Knockmore. I was always part of the club. I never really grew up feeling like I was out of place speaking to men about football.
Okay.
I was always part of, like, the club. I was always involved in the club. I played football myself. My father was coaching on underage. I used to be there all the time. So when I have a conversation with men about football, I never feel like they say, and these are people from around my own club, I never feel like they think, oh, she's a woman, like, she doesn't really know much about it. I always felt
that's good
to be in.
And the reason I ask is because I'm in broadcasting, or I'm in media all my life as well, and when I was 15, 16, 17 years of age, you would see those text messages coming in as soon as a female started talking about lads playing Gaelic. You'd see them coming in.
I suffered in a way, not suffered, but I experienced that you're a woman, like, going for jobs, not locally. But if I went, I went for a job nationally probably about 12 years ago now, and felt I had the experience in football, in sport in general, because I would watch... I mean, the only sport that I don't like is Formula One. I just can't get my head around watching it. But the rest of it, I would sit down for hours. Whatever's on, I'll watch. I felt like I had the knowledge of sport to apply for jobs on a national level. And I went to a place, had an interview with the person that was in control, and he's basically on the laptop, and he was like, not really interested. And he said, look, your stuff's good, your demo's good, you know, but to be honest, there's already two women working here already. So to be honest, you're like, there's too many women. Men don't really like listening to women doing sport.
Did he say that?
Yeah, he said this to me. I was thinking, I'm standing there going, oh my God, what the fuck? And I said to him, well, with all due respect, I think if you're, and I still have this feeling, I still think that, I think we're going now to an opposite side of it where you're like, women are getting jobs because they're women. And I do have an issue with that too. I think if you're qualified for the job, whether you're a man or a woman, that you should be being considered for the job on those merits and not because you're a woman. And I feel like now we're kind of going to a level where it's like, oh, well, you know, we better give it. If it was a man and a woman going for a job now, you kind of feel, well, the woman's going to get the job because they don't want to be seen as sexist. But like, this was probably 12 or 15 years ago. So this was time when it was okay to be sexist. And I was like, well, I feel like I'm good at the job. I don't. And he says, yeah, he says, to be honest, men don't really, they're not interested in listening to women. You know, it wouldn't work. There's too many women here already. And I said, right, so that's it. Oh yeah, look, if anything changes, we'll give you a call. And I just was like, fuck you, like, it's just, it's bullshit, like.
Yeah.
So I did experience it in that level, and that kind of then soured me, kind of like, oh God, I couldn't be bothered. Like, this is too much shit. I'm just gonna go and look for a job in media elsewhere, like PR, which I absolutely hated. I worked in PR for a while, but it was not for me. And you know, I genuinely didn't ever really experience that other than that time. And I don't experience it on a day-to-day basis.
Good.
But I do feel that there is this thing now where we're overcompensating for what we did 15, 20, 30, 40 years ago of not having women do things. And now it's nearly like a tokenism thing. And I know that there's a thing where the pendulum has to swing the exact opposite way in order for it to come back to the middle in order to eventually level itself out. Mm. It's not nice, and it's not like, I would hate to think I'd be getting something just because I was a woman and not getting it because I should be getting the job.
So you worked then in local radio then?
Yeah, well, I always have a connection to local radio. I worked in iRadio, which I left local radio to go to iRadio, which was kind of like a semi-national kind of radio station. And I absolutely loved that. And that's where I actually met Tommy and Hector, and that's how we got to know each other, became friendly, and we worked together there. My boss at the time was like, oh look, I've two fellas coming in who's going to do a radio show, didn't tell me who they were, they're coming in later, I want you to meet them because I think that you're going to, I was working in sport at the time, you're going to work with them, he says, I think that your personality and their personality get on. So as it happened, it was Tommy and Hector, and he was obviously, he was right, and we did get on great, and we'd a few great years together in radio, and I started off doing sport, and then I just became part of their show. And then they left, I was continued on iRadio. And then I sort of, you get kind of to a point, you're like, I'm here, I'm not going to really make any money at it. And you're sort of stuck at the same level, and there's only so much you can do. And you're kind of like,
oh. Well, no one does radio for money.
No.
That's for sure.
No.
Like, no one's,
you would never.
On a local level, no one's getting rich.
No. But the other thing is, you know, people, young people say to me, oh, how, like, I'd love to do this. Or I always say now, I'd never advise a young person to go and do media, like, as a course. Or, because, like, go and do something else, whatever it may be, whether it's nursing or veterinary or accountancy or whatever. Because if you want to get in to media, you'll get in. You know, you can be, you know, you can be there slaving away doing college courses and stuff. And the problem with that is you're qualified to do media, but you're not qualified to do anything else if the media doesn't work out. Whereas if you're qualified to do something and you want to do media, you can get into it. There's so many different ways. And nowadays, more than there ever was before, you know, you can write a column in the paper, you can do your own podcast, you can have a YouTube channel, you can get a radio show, you can do all that. So I would always say to younger people, don't isolate yourself by doing the media stuff, because he can come round to it at any point.
So you went your separate ways then, from the Tommy and Hector and yeah. iRadio thing, and then you went back then to Midwest for a while.
Yeah, I was back in Midwest doing bits and pieces in there. And
did you feel that was like a step back? Or
no, like? I never felt like that, and I never took that attitude ever.
As long as you were just doing the job, you were happy.
Yeah, I always took that, and I always had admiration for people who can go do a job and they can be there for like all their lives, or you know, they're doing the same job. I like have just like, I can't, I'm not interested, my attention span doesn't allow me to do that. That's because I'm not academically applied, like, so I'm kind of like, oh, I'm bored now, I want to go and do something else, or I was kind of floating around on it. And then I got out of media entirely by going to work for the hospice. But I still did a couple of shows on Midwest, because I still had a relationship with them and I was still able to cover and do that. And I loved that as well, because it meant I was staying in touch with what I liked doing.
It's a bug, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a bug. It's a disaster. You don't want it, but you love it and yeah. you can't help it. I continued to do that for a while, and then obviously COVID came, sort of everything. And then I had like 4 missed calls from Tommy one day, Tommy Tiernan, and it was like, I was like, what? Hello? And he goes, are we going to do something? Are we going to get back together? And I'm sort of bored. It's lockdown. I can't do anything. Let's try and do a podcast. Let's try and do something. So we created the podcast, and it's just, it worked out great. And it's, I love working with them. It doesn't feel like work, because you're not, I swear, we were never forced together in one sense. We just developed a relationship and we get on really well, and it's easy and it's not a chore. And we absolutely love doing the podcast, and we took a break from it because there's a lot of traveling going on, and we can, it's okay to do podcasts remotely once or twice or whatever, but if you're doing them over a couple of weeks, it's hard going, you know, it's, you don't get that same buzz as when you're together and the energy you get off people. So we're on a break now, and I have to say I'm loving it. I thought I would really miss it and really find it difficult to not be doing it, because we're doing it twice a week or whatever. But I'm enjoying it so far. I suppose I had the distraction of the president's trip and all the rest of it. But I miss it. And look, if we manage to last the 5 months, great. And if we don't, and we get back sooner, we'd be delighted.
I know a lot of people say, look, it's easy, you're sitting down talking for an hour. But like, there's an awful lot to it. Like, you're looking for content, you're trying to create different talking points, meet twice a week.
Yeah, I know it can be, of course. It's, you know, it comes across effortless and all of that. But it's still talking. Like, you're like, I love talking, but sometimes I get talked out, you know?
Yeah.
And it's hard. And if we were trying to some days do 2 in a row, and then that 2 in the one day, and then that was too difficult as well, because you're kind of like, oh, like, you have to remember that we might find it okay, but somebody's listening to this, and are they going to enjoy it? And we have the same energy buzz from it. So we didn't want to burn out and stop.
Okay.
Because we know we have something good going on there, so we were happier to take a break.
And do you mind me asking why you never did the video side of things?
Because we just about know how to record it. I remember we were doing our first one, again, we had absolutely no idea what we were doing, and we all had an understanding of radio, and I had a laptop that had, you know, the editing equipment on it. So I was like, I'll bring the editing equipment. Tommy had the microphones. We basically found a way of sticking them all into the laptop at the same time, the microphones, and we were like, oh my God, this is great. Oh my God, we can actually hear ourselves. Oh, we're recording. Oh, this is brilliant. Of course, it was a disaster, and I don't think we were ever able to even use the first episode we ever did. Maybe we'll be able to at some point use it, but because we're not tech. Any of us are tech. And I mean, if we ever have a little breakdown at all in communication in the studio, it's like, oh, press this button or turn it all off and turn it back on again. And like, we have no idea. So the commitment of doing the video stuff was probably another day's work. You know, I always loved about radio, you didn't have to have, you could go in your tracksuit and you could go in flattered, whether it be radio or whatever, and you didn't have to put on makeup and you didn't have to do your hair and you didn't have all that. So There is a side to that I like about radio, and everything is coming up in the videos. And we've discussed it, and we've said, "Oh, we'll definitely do that, and we'll definitely do it," and we just never did. So we just,
I love the fact that
we're not motivated in that sense.
I love the fact that there's no video, because when you're in, say, Leonard's pub there in Lahardon, Like, I'm visualizing wellies on the shelf, and there's a hacksaw, and then there's a loaf of bread, and there's a box of cornflakes, and you're forced to visualize that, where we're not forced to visualize that with anything anymore.
No, everything's just there. It's lazy anymore for people. That people don't have to use their imagination for anything. Like, everything, I mean, you don't even have to read an article in the paper anymore. It's at the top of it, it's like, press the button and you can listen to a summary of the article. You know, it's like, geez, like, everything is...
And without going back to the Joe Biden thing for too long, like, I was listening to Michael D. McAndrew's coverage of it in the car that night when Joe Biden was in Ballina. And I felt like I was there from listening to Michael D, where I wouldn't have got that from watching RT on the telly.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the presenter sits back and lets the camera do the talking.
Yeah.
Whereas Michael D is picking up on every little thing
that
you wouldn't even look out for if you were watching the telly.
Yeah.
And he's painting that picture. And he does it fantastic with football matches.
He does it as well, yeah.
That particular night, the coverage, and I even said it, I met Tommy Maron yesterday, who's the manager of Midwest. I met him on the street in Ballina, and I said that the coverage was just
incredible,
second to none.
Yeah.
I preferred listening to it than watching it.
Yeah, it's like, I love on a Sunday if you're in the car. Like, I mean, I'm more of a football Gaelic than hurling, but like, if I'm in the car on Sunday and Marty Morrissey or someone's doing a hurling commentary, like, there is nothing better than listening to that, because you're in the car, you're driving, and you're transported to that place by audio, you know, and that's the beauty of audio, and it's going to be the good and bad side of it. But like, people, for instance, we do our podcast in a shed at the bottom of Tommy's garden, and it's a hen house. And so people visualize what this hen house is like and what it looks like inside. And, you know,
the smell of cigars in there.
And there is a bloody smell of cigars. I can assure you, every time I leave, I'm like, for fuck's sake, I can smell that off my car.
The stink.
The stink, yeah, exactly. Well, it's probably better than hen shit, but I'm not sure. But yeah, so like, there is that side of it. And we love it, and it is nice. And people love it, and they're enjoying it. And it's like, you feel like you're part of the conversation with people. Like, I think that's why people are drawn to the show as well, in that it's three people having a conversation, like, as if you're in, and we go to the pub, but like, it's like if you're in the pub with your friends and you're listening, and people come in, say to me, it's like we're eavesdropping on a conversation, you know, if you're on the bus or the train, you're here overhearing some. That's what it feels like, that's why it works, and it that's what it is like. And it's very natural, and it's very not kind of prepared. We don't prepare stuff, we don't do stuff like that. So, you know, we don't have pre-production meetings and post-production meetings.
Okay,
we don't,
that's interesting.
We don't have topics. We say, oh, we're going to talk about this. Or we literally get a cup of tea in the morning or a cup of coffee when we get to Tommy's house, and we're not really allowed to talk, not even general stuff, not like chit-chat about what we did for the week.
Yeah, I like that.
Because that chit-chat then could lead to an interesting conversation. So that's how it works, and it's maybe that's why it can last as long as it is, because if you overthink something, sometimes it doesn't have the same.
I love how there's always, like, it's almost like three people in a ring, and you're waiting to latch on to that one thing. You know, my favorite episode was Gus Kelly.
Oh yeah, like, I mean, like, poor, who would have thought, like,
poor old Gus Kelly.
I was like, shit, like, oh my god, what are you bloody doing? And like, the more I said it, the more they just exploded with laughter.
And it just kept going and going and going, and I'm paying for the creche in cash, and
now everybody has this vision of like Gus Kelly going around
in
to
a
like
pinstripe
the horse
suit.
Racing and buying horses, and you know, in the paddock, and you know, all that stuff. And then it was the same with Auntie Ray, when Hector, we were like, Hector, you don't have an auntie called Ray, well, shut up, like. And then he was there ringing the cousins, what's her name, you know. So it's always the slagging and the fun and of it. So it's,
there's nothing real like that anymore, though. That's the beauty of it.
That's another part of it. That's again why it works, I suppose, and why it's a success, and you know, all of that. But it's lovely to be part of it, and I, you know, if it's lovely to do it with the two lads as well, because again, you're going back to, you know, kind of social media stuff, and every, like, when you're a woman, you're so examined about, like, probably the same for men, like, but from a woman's point of view, you're examined if you've too much weight, or you haven't enough makeup on, or you've too much makeup on, or your skin is bad, or you're, you know, there's always like questions, and you're always kind of hypersensitive to stuff like that. But when I'm with those two fellas who have so much experience in the media and all of that, you just don't feel like you have to be kind of up, you know, you can just feel like you're being yourself, and you know, there's no kind of,
I'm experiencing a lot of that recently. I'm getting a lot of comment on particular things.
It's
like,
weird, isn't it?
My eyebrows get a lot of abuse.
Why?
I don't know. Well, obviously
they're manicured or not manicured?
Not manicured enough. One of them is a bit invisible there. It's a bit blonde.
You need to start filling them in.
Yeah.
And then the problem is if you start getting them.
Oh, sure, you're a bollocks.
Done, well, what
look
the
at that
fuck
bollocks
that
filling out his
that
eyebrows.
Alan Kirk thinks he's, you know.
And then lately, I'm getting comment on my weight that I need to put on weight.
Yeah, like that's people what I mean. It's like it's mad, and especially. That was the one thing as well. I always preferred if I was doing radio with somebody else or I was doing some. Because when you're on your own, you're the sole focus of the attention and it's any little thing will be picked up. Oh, you pronounce that in a different way. Or
yeah.
You don't talk like that or you say that like, or you, and you're like, fuck off. Like.
One of the first hole openings I ever got on Midwest was, there's a village called Bacon.
Yeah.
But it's spelled
B-E-K-A-N. Yeah.
And I said Beacon.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, well, I'm not messing. I thought I wasn't going to make it out of the building alive.
Oh, it's well, now you see, that's the other side of it. And you know, you're local radio and you think you're like, you're from the place, you know.
Yeah.
And like, I slagged about this on the podcast before as well. I was saying like, I did the death notices one day, like, and that, I mean, you can forget about it if you get the death notices wrong. First of all, and like, even in Mayo, like Mayo is a massive county. Like, there's so many villages and
huge
townlands and places. And like, I think, I know like everywhere because I've been to, I'd say every village in Ireland, in Mayo, going to football matches, whether it was covering them for Midwest for soccer or football or going to them to watch Knockmore playing. And you think you know how to pronounce places. Oh my God. I mean, when I was told I had to read the death notices, I was as well off if I was been told that I had to be stood up and stripped naked.
The sweat is out in you.
It was too much for me.
Yeah.
And then the next thing the phone goes, well, she didn't pronounce that place right at all. And you're like, oh, fuck, I'm sorry. Like, or like I was doing a show one day and I forgot to play the bingo numbers. Well, honest to God, I was nearly like.
I've been that soldier.
Who do you think you are? Yeah. Like, you can fuck off with your songs.
Yeah.
Get so the bloody bingo.
Halfway through the walk of life, then you have to stop it and say, sorry. I forgot to play the bingo numbers. Join David now for today's bingo numbers.
You could be in the middle of telling your life story and that you're about to drop off.
They don't care.
And then the next thing is, sorry, I'm sitting here with the pen in my hand with the bingo numbers.
Yeah.
Would you get them on? Like, you know.
And I think one of the biggest compliments I've ever been given was, God, you're lovely at reading the death notes.
Well, that's now.
There's a lady out our way.
I mean, that's as good as you can get.
And every time I meet her, she goes, oh, I do miss you on the radio. And I, not that I was on it that often. Well, I suppose you're covering for everyone.
Yeah.
And you think you're not on it often, but people do build up. And every time I meet her now, she goes to me, oh, you were brilliant at the deaths. You were brilliant. And then if she saw me reading the deaths, sweat pouring down my face, you're running out to the receptionist
going,
how do you pronounce this? How do you pronounce this?
And no matter how many times you practice it, you won't get it right.
You're there phonetically trying to write it out.
Oh, and, nightmare.
Oh, the stress. And they go on for about 5 or 6 minutes.
Oh, stop. I mean, I can't. Honestly, that was like more stressful than anything. I used to do the election coverage, which I loved, you know, going off down to Sligo and doing the coverage. Loved all that. Like, it didn't matter what situation you'd be thrown into there live. No problem. Death notices, absolutely no thank you. I was like, oh, please, can someone else just do them, please? I used to say to receptionists, please, can you just pre-record them? But no, it's, you know, it was a great learning curve, though, being on local radio, because there's a certain element that you're allowed to get away with, and you can make loads of mistakes, and you can learn from them, and you can, you know, get your own rhythm in it. And I always felt that it was the best place to learn, you know, than having to go off and try and make it. And
Midwest listeners let you away with nothing, though.
No, nothing,
Like, when I was on Galway Bay FM, you could say anything and it'd go over their head.
Yeah.
The majority of the time.
Yeah.
I'd be on the breakfast show.
You see, pure loyalty with Midwest listeners who turn that radio on in the morning and they won't turn it off in the evening. And
they
know your every wake and move, you know.
They have a share in the business.
Yeah. Or, like, when I went, was in Midwest, and then I went to iRadio, like, you meet people and it's like that. They'd be like, oh, it's great you're on the radio, blah, blah, blah. And then you're gone and you're like, oh, like, I thought, you know, naively, oh, well, I thought iRadio was, you know, hipper, trendier, cooler, you know. Nobody even heard of it. Like, what are you talking about? Like, pop yourself on kind of thing, you know. So no matter what you do, local radio is where the people around you are attached to and associated with. But I know it's a great place to start, I have to say.
Have you got any further goals or ambitions?
5-year plans. What's the 5-year plans? I don't know. I'm a kind of an well, I don't know if it's unusual, but I'm very like, oh, sure, look at, sure, see what happens. Sure, you know, I always feel like if you have too many plans and they don't work out, sure, that's another day's work and that's another stress, you know. No, I mean, I didn't have an ambition to do a podcast. I'm doing it and I love it. And so I don't really like, I don't have any aspirations to become the next presenter of the Late Late Show or ever.
Have people been hounding you for a live podcast?
Yeah, a live podcast, yeah. And it's something that we are thinking of doing and we're looking at. And again, we're like, yeah, yeah, we'll do it at some stage. We're an unmotivated bunch, as you may have gathered. But yeah, like that sort of stuff, would love to do it. Yeah, great. If it works out, it works out. Great, would love to do it. But like I'm not sure about plans or aspirations. I don't really know, to be honest. I'm just happy enough to, you know, to be healthy and happy and just take every day as it comes. I'm not a great woman for too many plans, to be honest. I don't really like making plans for a month's time because I'm really tied down to that, you know.
I'm the same, yeah. And what do you do in your downtime, Ben? What do you do to chill out?
I hate to admit this as a woman in her late 30s, but I've got an Xbox and I play FIFA.
Cool.
A lot.
And does NBA the beloved basket. Play with you?
No, but no, absolutely. You have to do that in my pure own down time. Like, okay. As in nobody else in the house. I mean, I play with my nephews.
Is 13. It like a dirty secret?
Yeah, I mean, even saying it out loud is kind of like, shit, I've got an Xbox. I only bought it for myself for my birthday present. Like,
cool.
Last birthday. So yeah, an Xbox. I played that. It was always something I had as a kid. Me and my brother had like an Atari, a Sega, you know.
What's your first game that you remember?
Oh, it was always like Sonic the Hedgehog. Sonic the Hedgehog.
Did you have Paperboy? Did you ever have that game on the Atari? Sorry, okay, go on.
Not sure.
Sonic the Hedgehog. What
Maybe
else?
I did. I can't remember. It was always Sonic the Hedgehog and Tetris-y things and, you know. And then always was FIFA, like FIFA, whatever year it was. NFL games, basketball, more sporty stuff. I'm not really into the... I'm not really into like the Grand Theft Auto and stuff like that. I'm afraid I could probably get too into it and I want to go around shooting people. I'm not.
I don't think so. I was watching
a surgeon, a neurosurgeon on with Tommy one day and he was saying he does that in his downtime, plays like precise video games. So I thought when he does it and he's like in his 50s, whatever, I think, nah, probably okay for me today. So I do that in my own downtime. Well, I like, literally would not admit that. I'm after admitting that to you now. And I shouldn't have. Because like, I don't even tell my friends that I do that. I'm like, oh, what are you doing? Oh, nothing, just reading or whatever. And I'm like, they're playing. Fuck, stop ringing me. I'm in the middle of a game, you know. I'm in the middle of managing Liverpool to you know, like the FA Cup final. Like, would you back off, you know? Yeah. So that's sort of stuff that I'm into. And then obviously like music and just listening to embarrassing kind of like country music stuff and not Irish country, more American country, like listening to that kind of stuff. And I love the idea of holidays and trying to get away as much as possible and as much time as I can to get away. And it's not that I'm a sun worshipper either. I think it's just the idea of being away and just nice. I'm a typical white. Like I've absolutely got no genes to get a tan at all. Like it's just I've like zero carotene in my body and like or whatever it is called. But I can't get a tan. I just don't like it. So if I'm away on holidays, then I like to kind of doing stuff, kind of, you know.
I love that you have that thing and that it's the gaming. And I think everyone needs a thing. And yeah. My dad used to rent a Sega for me every second week.
Brilliant.
So we'd go into Gavin's in Castlebar and you'd get to hire the Sega for the weekend for two nights.
I loved it.
And get two games for £10.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember you used to be able to rent the games. Like, yeah. You'd be going and renting
them for the weekend.
And so, yeah, like me and my brother, like if we were had any kind of spare cash, well, he was 4 years older than me, so I was always relying on him to have the cash as opposed to me. But yeah, I was just always doing that, renting out games. And that was a simpler time though, you know, like you'd never think to have kind of, you'd always only rent games. You never bought them or had them. You know? So for me to buy the Xbox was a bit of a guilty pleasure, but I said, why not? Just
fantastic.
Yeah. So I don't. My best friend doesn't even know that I have an Xbox. Like, I wouldn't admit to another grown adult that I have. I do that, but now I have.
Are you happy the way things are going?
Yeah, I love it. I'm happy. I'm not good with being stressed or anxious or that. So I try not to be that way. But obviously, you'd have anxieties all the time and all of different little bits and pieces. But try not to let them harbour on. And I try to be as good a person as I can be. And
when you say you try not to let them harbour on,
just like sometimes, I hate having anxieties. Like, I don't like people, you know, I wouldn't like for me to have upset somebody by saying something or doing something. And then that would, if I was going on, it would like really fucking eat me up. Like, I'd hate it. And I just, like, some people, this doesn't bother them, or I don't know if it does or not, but it bothers me to a point where I can't cope with that. I don't like having having animosity with somebody, or, you know, it stresses me out too much. So I try to just not let it happen, or if it does happen, to try and sort it out and
fix
it up.
Yeah.
And just different worries and stress about work and stuff like that. So I try not to overthink things. So I think that's why I kind of don't overly focus on, what am I going to be doing in, you know, years time, or because that's a pressure that you don't need. Like, if you don't reach that expectation, then, and it's, then you start like having self-doubt. Well, why didn't I, like, what's wrong with me that I didn't achieve that goal? Or like, it's pressure that's not necessary, you know. Like, it might be replaced by something else, then your path of life might have gone a different way. So why get stressed about something that you thought a year ago was a good thing to do, but in actual fact it's led you to something else? So I try to, for that reason, just kind of live on the edge of.
I find you absolutely fascinating, and I've listened to every single episode of the THL podcast, you know, and I've always wanted to talk to you, and I think the Joe Biden visit pushed me to contact you.
I'm glad it was lovely to actually do it.
And I do appreciate you taking the time, and I felt bad messaging you, and, you know, I felt like a bit of a bollocks saying, how are you?
If I thought you were being a bollocks, I'd have told you were being a bollocks. Or I'd have completely ignored you.
But, you know, you've spent 2 hours with me here in Mount Falcon Estate, and honestly, I can't thank you enough.
Well, it was my pleasure, and I love it. So I love all the stuff that you do. And I think what you're doing is, you're niche in what you're doing as well, Alan. And it's good and it's fun, and like, people, like, you've so many like super fans as well, in a way. Like, I meet so many people. I was telling people that you're coming on, oh, I love him, oh, Jesus, he's great crack, I love his videos, I love his stuff. So keep doing what you're doing.
How many million downloads are you on now?
Well, I don't know, the last count was 20 million. So
20 million.
It's mad. Like, it sounds ridiculous. It sounds mad. Like, it is mad when you think about it.
All over the world.
All over the world. It was interesting, actually. Once, a few months in, we got like a breakdown of the countries that people were listening to the podcast in, and like, one person listening in the Yemen, and you're like, I want to know that person. I want to know, why are they listening?
Yeah.
You know, obviously it's all Irish people generally. Like, although I've got some cousins who are, parents were Irish, they're born, bred Americans, and they're absolutely love it, you know, the podcast. And you think a lot of the stuff is Irish references that would go over their head, you know, but they get it and they love it. And
do you know where your second most popular country is after Ireland? No, second or third?
I don't know. I mean, I probably presume it would be the UK and sort of America and stuff. But the other like random ones, like Colombia. And
when you go in and look at the statistics, you've had a download in every country in the world, I'd
say.
You know, because I'm only at 350,000.
Yeah, there's some people listening in Russia, like, or in North Korea. I don't know if you can, probably can't get North Korea's viewers or listenership, but yeah. But
how are they allowed to listen to the THL podcast over
exactly
there?
I would say safely North Korea probably now, in hindsight, wasn't on that list, but yeah.
All right, look, and I'm going to let you go. When can we expect the THL podcast back?
Well, it's back in September.
You're not going to last until September now.
I know, yeah. Well, I was walking down the street in Dublin the other day, and I had my AirPods in, and I was talking to Tommy, and I said to him, I'm getting, like, it's, maybe we should come back, you know, before September. I said, we might miss each other too much, you know, and I'm always saying that. Miss ye, you know, and there I was like, we'll get lost, like. And there was a fellow walking in front of me and he said, I knew the voice. He was like, tell him I agree. And I was like, guys, I said, come on. I said, the people on the street too. So, you know, I don't know. Look, it's amazing how time bloody passes so quickly anyway. You're kind of like, we're already a month into it, like, you know. So we've only four more to go. So, I mean, once... We might be back a bit earlier. She'd never.
You might
know.
Even do a bonus one.
We might do a bonus one. Yes, we might do an odd bonus one.
The people want it. Give them what they want.
I know. I totally agree. You have to tell the other two.
And I had to laugh as well. You were saying, like, what if one of us dies?
I know.
Would we do a podcast then?
Oh, they'd be like, yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. I was like, of course, get rid of me. I said, you won't care at all. Like, but yeah, no. So it's great, and I'm delighted to have been on with you. So thank you very much.
Thanks very much. I really appreciate it.
We might do another one when the president gets re-elected.
When he gets re-elected,
to annoy the Trump supporters there.
I want on the plane next time.
Well, I'll be on it as well.
I was watching from an old cold hangar in Ireland West Airport.
Oh, well, look, but it was a good place to be as well. So, yeah.
Thanks a million.
No problem. Thanks.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The Big News Coming Soon podcast is proudly sponsored by B&B Homes. B&B Homes is Ireland's number one award-winning manufacturer of factory-built homes. We take your home from start to finish. Our homes are A-rated and meet planning regulations. We build to your requirements and your budget. The cost includes your home being turnkey and our chartered engineers' fees. Please get in touch for a viewing of our show homes, a brochure, or for more information. Let B&B Homes take the stress out of your build. Check out brbhomes.ie.